Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gabby Logan here. Welcome to The Midpoint. Today, my guest is an expert on a topic I think is of particular interest to those of us in midlife. Our special subject today is ultra-processed food, aka UPF. Sexy, I know. But UPFs are being talked about more and more. And when you start to look around in the supermarket, you realise they are absolutely everywhere. So what are they? What are they doing to our bodies? And why are they so prevalent in modern diets? These are all questions I'm hoping that Dr. Chris Van Tulleken will answer for us. Chris's latest book, Ultra Processed People, Why Do We All Eat Stuff That Isn't Food? And Why Can't We Stop? Is already a bestseller. As well as an author, Chris is an infectious diseases doctor, has a PhD in molecular virology from University College London, where he's also an associate professor, and is one of the BBC's leading science presenters, having made countless programmes for children and adults, including The Doctor Who Gave Up Drugs and Operation Ouch. Alongside his twin brother Zand, he also presents a thorough examination for BBC Radio 4. Today we're going to find out what prompted him to explore this particular element of food science, what he learned, and how we can avoid UPF in our busy everyday lives. I'll also be asking him some of the questions you very kindly sent in via Instagram. We've got a lot to get through, so let's get going. Chris, thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint.
Such a pleasure.
In your introduction, I've kind of done a little description of UPFs, but what I want you to talk about is why you became interested in them and the moment with the ice cream. If you could just tell us about with your daughter when you started to work out that the ice cream wasn't melting.
It's a bit of a journey from infection to nutrition, but when I was a young doctor, I worked in very low-income settings in Central African Republic, in South Asia and Pakistan. And I saw a lot of kids very ill or dying because of the aggressive marketing of baby food that their parents had to make up with dirty water. Their parents couldn't afford it, so they would dilute it. And it didn't matter how many antibiotics we had. You can't save a child that's just drinking, you know, sewage water mixed with baby food. And the same companies that were doing that are the same companies that are selling baby food in the UK. They sell us our grown-up food. They sell food all around the world. They're very large transnational companies. So I suppose my research moved from infectious diseases and virology into studying how what we call the commercial determinants of health, how big corporations, food, alcohol, tobacco, pharma, tech, how they affect human health.
And then one day...
I was in the park with Lyra, who's my eldest, and I guess at the time she was about three, and we got her this very fancy artisanal pistachio ice cream. And
so in your brain, you think to yourself, this is
oh, so expensive. Good stuff. It was like, you know, £3 a scoop or something. And so she had it in a, you know, little cardboard tub, and she was just sort of chatting with her friends and handed it to me to go on the swings. And the ball was still there. She'd had a few scoops, but it was still a perfect ball. And it was a hot day. It was quite early in the year, but still hot. And it just hadn't melted. And it was a warm foam. And so that sparked really me to start looking into why does ice cream not melt? And I spoke to an incredible guy, Paul Hart, who's a big character in the book, and he died a few months ago, but he became a good friend, and he'd been an ice cream scientist at Unilever. He was a biochemist. And he said the project for ice cream companies all over the world is to get ice cream they don't need to freeze at all, just to have foams that can be cooled down at home or in a shop at the last minute, because that would save them huge amounts of money. And they haven't quite got there yet, but what we have is these ice creams, and this is almost all the ice cream you buy will have stabilizers, gums, and emulsifiers in it that mean that, you know, in the drive home from supermarket, from freezer in the supermarket to self transported all over the country, it stays exactly the same. The ice crystals don't form.
And when you first read that, you know, the kind of the immediate alarm bell goes, well, I'm never going to eat ice cream again. And
yeah,
I'm
going
to, yeah, exactly.
Especially if you've got kids.
I'm only going to have it when it's kind of from, you know, somebody that's made it locally,
homemade artisan
ice cream. But of course, all these things become very practical, don't they? And a lot of UPF's history, I guess, is down to practicality.
100%. So industrialized food was a big part of helping women enter the workplace. So one of the critiques that's leveled at me by food industry commentators is, I want everyone to start home cooking, and that's going to shove a burden onto, you know, it's typically shoved onto mums and women to do that. Of course, I don't want that. I have no opinion about what anyone should eat at all. I think in the whole book, there is no advice. What there is information. How people use that is very specific to them. The reality of the food system in the UK is that ultra-processed food is the only affordable, available food for many people. If you, you know, my colleagues in the hospital, many of them are on night shifts. They're not on big incomes, and they've seen a real-time deflation in their wages. And they need to eat ultra-processed food. It's all that's available in the hospital. They don't have any time to cook. They're not batch cooking at home. So this is the reality of the food system. And we need to be thinking in terms of big system changes. But what in everything I say, and I hope everything I write, at the core of it is not making life more expensive and trying to reduce some of the shame and stigma that people feel around food.
Let's get to why that's important, because you do talk a lot and you go into the science and the various papers that have been done, although it seems like there's loads more to do in this area, you know, from what you talk about, that, okay, might not all be bad, and we'll get onto that as well, but why we shouldn't have a diet that is dominated by ultra-processed foods, and what you've learned about how that's affecting us as the human race.
So the science is pretty clear. You know, in the UK, we're dragging our heels and saying there's more work to be done. I'll tell you what, UNICEF, who have the best nutrition team of any institution in the world virtually, they believe the science. We've got research groups at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cambridge, my group at UCL. You know, they all believe the science. We've got governments like France, Belgium, Canada, Israel, almost all the governments in South and Central America, they believe the science and are issuing warnings. The reason we don't change the environment here is because the food industry has very, very complete control over nutritional messaging. Now, this sounds a bit tinfoil hat, a bit conspiracy, but let's look at the picture. So we have our biggest food charities, like the British Nutrition Foundation. Their Healthy Eating Week last year was sponsored by Coca-Cola. Now, whether you believe all the evidence on ultra-processed food or not, we can all agree that the Coca-Cola Corporation doesn't have a healthy product portfolio. Okay, they're also sponsored by McDonald's. They have corporate members, including all the major supermarkets. So that's our leading food charity. They advise government, they advise the public. We've then got the Government Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition. Now, this is an august body that issues very sort of robust advice. About half of its members have declared relationships with companies like and including Coca-Cola. So you can't, if you have the Government Nutrition Committee being partly funded by the food industry, that creates a real risk. Then we have university departments funded by Pepsi and Mars. And so we have an environment, and then we have the Science Media Centre, who sort of helps sort out all the science stories that go into the UK press. They're funded by Nestle, Procter & Gamble and Food Drink Europe. So industry has a lot of control of the messaging. And then we have the influencers and lots of the doctors that you see on social media partner with companies that make ultra-processed food. I won't name any names, but you know, it's pretty easy to find out who they are.
So ultra-processed foods, as a simple definition, anything that is removed from its natural state or added to by a product that is not
so there's a very long, it's a formal definition. It's not like junk food. It's not a casual word. It's a definition housed by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. It's about 9 paragraphs long, but it boils down to this. If you look on your packet and you see an ingredient that you don't normally find in a domestic kitchen, like xanthan gum or a stabilizer or an emulsifier or flavorings or extracts, it's probably an ultra-processed food. If you're reading an ingredients list at all, it's probably ultra-processed. If it's a food product made by a very big transnational corporation, it's probably ultra-processed, because whether you look at Kellogg's or Nestle or Danone or any of the big food companies, almost all of them, the majority of their products will be ultra-processed, because this is how you make money.
And the reason why ultra-processed foods are causing so many health issues?
Well, we have, first of all, let's say, well, what's the evidence they do cause harm? We've got very good big epidemiological studies. So the kind of studies that we use to link cigarettes with lung cancer, we now have really a very, very large number, probably more than 100 of those kind of studies linking ultra-processed foods to inflammatory bowel disease, dementia, anxiety, depression, cancers, metabolic disease, weight gain and obesity, and early death from all causes. So according to World Health Organization data and Lancet data, poor diet has overtaken tobacco as the world's leading cause of early death. Okay, so we're in a real crisis, and the UK has some of the worst rates in the world. So that kind of big population data is very robust. We're sure this food is causing harm. And we've got studies on animals and small studies on humans where we can point at emulsifiers or softness or calorie density or high levels of sugar, fat and salt. I mean, we've got really good evidence around them. And almost all UPF has high levels of sugar, fat and salt. So we've got very, very good evidence it's harmful. How does it harm us? Well, it does it in a few different ways. And it depends what the thing you're interested in is. Let's look at obesity, because that is probably responsible for more suffering in this country at the moment than almost any other health problem, because it leads to so many other problems. And because people who live in larger bodies are discriminated against by their doctors, by their workplaces, by everyone. And now we've got, you know, 60% of people living with excess weight. So the reason it drives weight gain is partly because it's very soft. The best example might be supermarket bread. You go and buy a big loaf, you can squash that loaf down to nothing. You can eat a slice of supermarket bread, you know, really quickly. Go and buy a loaf of real bread. It will cost you perhaps 10 times more. You know, my local fancy bakery, a loaf of bread is £6. Mm. But it will take you twice as long to eat it. It'll also go stale very quickly. So the speed with which we consume the food means that it bypasses all the hormones and nerve signals inside our body that tell us when to stop eating. So we can then look at levels of sugar and levels of salt and flavorings and all the other ways the food is engineered to drive excess consumption. But the truth is, any one product, whether it's a chew bar or a breakfast cereal, it's got thousands of properties. Okay, it's got all the nutrients and the texture and the taste. It's also got the cartoon character on the box and the ad. Every single property has been dialed up to 11 by brilliant scientists working very hard in labs over many decades, so that every single property drives excess consumption. So we know that the marketing makes kids eat more of the food. We know that the flavoring does. We know that the coloring of the box changes the way the food tastes. So you can't, you can try and deconstruct it, and we've got good evidence. But the big picture is, when I go and speak to food company scientists, and the book is full of testimony essentially from whistleblowers, they all agree. They're all like, no, we make the food to drive you to eat all of it, because that's the only way we can make money, right? We've got enough calories in this country. You just have to get inside the head of being a food company executive. If you manufactured a product that really filled people up and they didn't eat too much of, would that product survive in the marketplace? Of course it wouldn't. You know, you have to make a product that people want to eat for breakfast, lunch and dinner 7 days a week. And it has to have a nearly infinite shelf life, so that if it's a Christmas thing, you can make it all in January. You don't have to make it all in the week before Christmas, you know.
The other thing you said there in the list of things that, you know, are going wrong with us as a society in terms of what food's doing to us, mental health issues. And gut health is increasingly, thankfully, becoming a more talked about and real subject for people to understand the gut microbiome, but also how that links to mental health. So are UPFs directly related to that as well?
Yes. So this is food that is generally very low in fiber. And we know there's a lot of sort of nonsense around gut health. What we are absolutely sure about is that eating beans, pulses, fruit and vegetables is really good for your gut, okay? And eating ultra-processed food, or even very processed food, processed meats, is pretty bad for your gut. Beyond that, what we're then seeing in the middle is that the food industry has very skillfully taken that knowledge about fruit and veg, and they've gone, oh, well, maybe we could make branded products with like fiber extracts in them and also add lots of sugar, but not mention that too much, and make like little shots that would be really good for your gut. And there's no evidence at all that probiotics, prebiotics, postbiotics, fiber extracts, that any of that is good for your gut. If you want to look after your gut, eat real, normal food, cook it at home. And that's kind of the state of the evidence. And you do not need supplements and pills and potions.
But why? You know, I totally understand.
So how, does it, so
how is it okay. affecting your mental health if you don't
so,
do that?
So how this food affects your mental health? You know, we could probably talk for 2 hours about all the different possible mechanisms. One of the most important things is this microbiome that lives inside our gut. So in terms of the cells in your body, you probably have as many bacterial cells as human cells. They're the biggest organ in your immune system. And when you put real food in your mouth and you swallow it, the bits you can't digest get to your colon. And the fiber, the stuff you can't digest, is eaten by the bugs there. And they ferment it and they turn it into little molecules that are really important for your brain and for controlling inflammation and for controlling your immune system and for generally improving the heart of almost every organ in your body. Now, when you start feeding these bugs molecules that they don't like, or when you start eating a diet that promotes bugs flourishing that shouldn't be there, Do we understand all the effects? No. Do we think it's pretty bad for you? Yes. And we can show with some of the additives, and probably it's also to do with the high levels of fat, sugar, and salt, but some of the additives we know have significant effects on the microbiome. So the emulsifiers occur in real food, like egg yolk is an emulsifier, or mustard in a salad dressing. It mixes water and oil. But the soap is also an emulsifier. And we think that some of the synthetic emulsifiers in food act a bit like detergent. So in a simple way, when you consume lots of them, they scrub out your gut, they thin the protective mucus, they change the bacteria. We know that the non-nutritive sweeteners, even the natural artificial sweeteners, you know, the things that taste sweet but don't have many calories, they seem to have very significant effects on the microbiome as well.
So effectively, really good food, the pulses, the seeds, the nuts, all the, you know, the vegetables, the legumes, they are helping to feed the good.
You're putting good soil in for the right plants to grow. That's how I'd think about it. And you don't need to be fancy about it. You don't need to go and buy capsules and special fibers and things. It's all in real food. And in fact, there's some evidence that eating fiber in the context of real food is, we know that's extremely good for you. We're not sure that if you strip the fiber out, you know, you'll often see corn fiber or citrus fiber as an additive, and it makes a health claim. We're not really sure that kind of fiber is particularly good for you. We know that eating a banana, an apple, a head of broccoli, or a can of beans is good for you.
It'll come up in some of the questions that we've been sent in, but you focus a lot in the book on diet products or products that claim lots of different health properties, which I think overall, basically your take is that anything that says it's a diet product or it's low in sugar or it's low in fat is generally not a good thing.
And almost any pack with a health claim is likely to be ultra processed and is often likely to be very high in sugar and salt and often high in fat. I've got a pack of Cocoa Pops at home that I use as a prop. It has 12 health claims. Now, it also has above the UK dietary recommended levels of sugar and salt, and it is ultra processed. And I don't think there's anyone...
How can you be allowed to have both of those in one place?
It seems entirely illogical. So one of the strategies that the South American public health experts are using is they say, well, if the food has a warning label for salt, you can't make a health claim. I mean, that's just blindingly obvious. You can't have food that's good and bad for you. You know, there's just
food. Which bit am I eating of it then?
Right. And we also know that if you cook at home, that those kind of ingredients seem to be much less harmful, probably because we use much less of them. So yeah, a good rule is if you're eating like a Nutri bar, a supplement, anything that's saying it's good for you, you know, broccoli, eggs, milk, they don't have health claims on the pack. They're just food. Can I say one? Because I know you're particularly interested in mental health. There is one aspect to this food. Because it's engineered to drive excess consumption, much of it has become quite addictive for many people. So there'll be lots of people listening to this who feel a little bit out of control with this food. And I'm certainly one of those people. And the idea of addiction has been controversial, but addiction's quite simple. It's can you stop using a substance or a product even when you try and quit it and you know it's doing you harm, physical, social, mental harm. And so the addictive property of the food is really kind of taking away people's agency. And being addicted to anything is incredibly damaging to mental health. Mm. It's very distracting. It's a big burden. And then we know the food is also driving weight gain, which causes mental health problems. Mm. So there are these very direct effects of the food, the inflammation, the microbiome on the body. Mm. But the very fact of us not feeling
the more insidious
like we can
things
stop,
that happen,
it's all undermining mental health.
Yeah, of course. And then your inability to move how you want and not exercise and not give yourself those positive hormones, those hormonal
releases. You get constipated, you get sleep deprived. The physical problems, they also erode your mental health and often drive you to consume more of the food. In the way that smokers, the stress of trying to quit often drives them to smoke more cigarettes. So as the food causes health problems, you seek the short-term solutions of the food, of tobacco, of alcohol, of social media, of all these other things that interact with our bodies in the same way.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
We'll be right back. Okay, let's crack on with some questions. And this has occurred in a few different guises, this question. Angie says, how do I convince my family that eating ultra-processed food is not good for them? I have 18-year-old twins. I know you love a human experiment. And, you know, you talk about...
I want to get yours
my
on,
twins.
On deli.
Because they have such totally different attitudes towards food, right? And I totally appreciate this. It doesn't matter what I say. The messages seem to go into my daughter, and she kind of buys it, and she eats what we all eat. Away from home, my son is not buying into what I'm saying, right? So I'm not able to influence the fact that ultra-processed food is definitely still a big part of his life. And a lot of people are talking about teenagers in the questions that have come in, and it's so frustrating when you want to help them and you know life will be better for you if you do this.
I would love some advice from your listeners, because I have a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 2-month-old. So I still have some control over what they eat. My approach is there are two things. First of all, even with a 6-year-old, I don't control everything. I don't control what they eat.
Well, when they go to parties and things, you can't.
Right, and what's very important, I think, is food binds us to the people around us. I don't want them being weird. I want them to have normal friendships, and sharing food is important. So they can eat whatever they want when they go to a party. At home, I try and make sure we know that part of all of these kind of behaviors that are harmful is opportunity. You know, if cigarettes are, if you're smoking, I'll probably have one too. If you're having a glass of booze, I might join in. So making these things unavailable helps a lot. And it actually makes kids feel better if the food isn't around. Mm. So in my household, look, I have not cracked this code. We really have got rid of most of the junk. We used to have a big bowl of it that was kind of a way I'd prove to journalists that I was like hip and normal. And increasingly just the kids were eating chocolate bars, you know, a couple of times a day. And there was always like pudding was always from this big blue bowl of stuff from grandparents from parties. So we've got rid of that. And actually the kids are much happier not endlessly talking about the big blue bowl. We only have water and milk for them to drink. And that's kind of the one thing. It's maybe the one hard line I have is we don't have any soft drinks in the house. And that comes from colleagues at the World Health Organization who just have that as their form of religion. It's just kids should just drink milk and water. Other drinks are so harmful for their teeth.
Completely unnecessary.
So that's the one hard line. But part of it also is like, don't try and persuade your kids, because one of the journeys in the book is my twin. I've got an identical twin. He went and lived in the States. He was very stressed there. He put on a huge amount of weight. And for a decade, I nagged him. I tried to control him. Mm. And my family, you know, I'm from a wonderfully loving family, but we do love to get up in each other's grills. And I speak to a therapist in the book who says, you have to just let this go. And in the end, my project as a physician and as a broadcaster, as a scientist, is I want to change the environment for everyone. I want warning labels on the food. Mm. I want to reduce the influence of industry, but I will not tell people what to eat. And my advice to any listener dealing with a teenager is they're essentially a grown-up and just
love find
them.
Their
you
own
can't,
way.
You can't be the barrier. And they will, kids are smart, actually. We know from evidence from Chile where they've put these warning labels, these big black stop signs on the food. Kids ask their parents not to buy it. Just as you and I probably remember telling our parents not to smoke. Mm-hmm. I remember saying to my dad, you know, that isn't good for you. You know, I'd had some lesson at school. And kids, you know, I do a kids show on the BBC, Operation Ouch. And the kids we speak to, they want to be strong and well and smart and successful and be good at sport.
But as you say, the environment, I find it so depressing when I'm driving in the morning and I see kids 13, 14 drinking huge energy cans of energy drinks and big chocolate bars as their breakfast on the way to school.
And there's no warning on any of that. Even
but it's the environment. That's what
warning.
They're picking up at shops, right? That's just there in front of them. It's what everybody's doing.
Those harmful products, you don't have to believe any of the evidence on ultra processing to agree on fat, salt and sugar. That evidence is the jury is in. Everyone agrees on it. Why is there not a warning about the amount of sugar on a can of cola? There's a little tiny red traffic light, but there are 3 green traffic lights, so that according to our current labeling, a can of cola is 3/4 healthy. A can of diet cola is 4 green traffic lights, the healthiest thing you can buy. It's really...
And
what
yet,
it should have is a big
South
black
America
stop
sign. Is doing this?
They're doing it incredibly well. They are pushing rocks uphill because the food industry has... Any one of the big companies that make our food, they have revenues roughly equivalent to the GDP of a medium-sized South American country. Okay, that's how powerful one of these companies are. So you cannot understand their sort of political power. But because the tragedy there was so sudden, they had an influx of American food, and within a generation, sudden there was this explosion of obesity and type 2 diabetes. And so there was great population desire to, it was very great clarity of like, oh, it's those products we have to put warning labels on. The UK, it's crept up on us. You know, we've gradually been since the 70s. It's been 50 years of it trickling into our diet. And suddenly it's most of what we eat. But a lot of the products in the UK are dressed up as health food. And that's why on the cover of the book, there's a loaf of brown bread. Because that brown bread is, it's soft. It's incredibly energy dense. It's got emulsifiers in it. It's got very high levels of sugar, very high levels of salt. And yet brown bread is the sort of...
It pretends to be good.
It's the thing we all lean on as being healthy. It's what we serve our kids in the morning.
And New Zealand, I've just as an example, my husband was there not so long ago, and he said it was so marked that he'd go into a store and all he could see was good stuff. Because
so interesting.
Yeah, the other stuff was pushed up very, very high or very, very low. And he said he felt like there were... And he felt he was in, I'll say it, Whole Foods, you know, which is the kind of like, I'd say the shop in this country that probably has more... natural products than maybe he felt like he was in a health store.
I go around Whole Foods with a slightly different eyeball, but supermarkets are more or less all the same, because they're all, with the exception of Waitrose is unusual because it's not owned by institutional investors, it's employee owned, so it's a slightly, and that when you go in, not to promote Waitrose, you know, I have no relationships with any of these people, but it does feel a bit different. They're less interested in driving this kind of incredible rate of growth that all the other supermarkets
have. Yeah, let's not even get on for like 3-for-1s and all that kind of stuff.
We know the bog-offs don't save money.
No. So let's move to another question, because I'm going to run out of time with you, which is annoying because there's so much more to talk to you about. This was another one we had quite a few questions about as well, which is to do with oils. Claire wonders, what is your opinion on vegetable oil and rapeseed oil? The minute you walked in, I talked to you about oils you know, should we be cooking with them? Should we be avoiding certain oils in certain foods?
So I would say that the best evidence shows that the reason we're thinking the seed oils are harmful is because they're almost all being used in ultra processed foods. So it's very hard to sort of disentangle that evidence statistically. What we're very clear about, in fact, one of the reasons the definition of ultra-processed food was created is because the Brazilian team noticed this paradox where families that were buying lots of oil and sugar were healthier than families that weren't. Now, the families that weren't were still eating the oil and sugar, but they were eating it in these new ultra-processed products. So buying sugar, salt, and oil and fat is ingredients is a sign of good health. Now, we could go toe-to-toe on, is it better to have cold-pressed rapeseed oil and extra virgin olive oil, and are they better than just plain old vegetable oil? I'd say that's gilding the lily, if you like. If you are home cooking using ingredients, it doesn't matter really if your butter is grass-fed and your oil is cold-pressed. You're cooking food at home, and you won't, when you cook at home, you're not doing it to drive excess consumption and to drive increased purchasing and to make money for yourself. You're doing it because you love your kids, and you won't add loads of salt. And we know when people cook at home, they're moderate with oils. So the levels of salt in ultra-processed food are so much higher than you cook with at home. And then you eat way more of that food because of the way it's engineered, because its logic is to make money. So if anyone,
so you're not going to split hairs about oil.
I really am not going to split hairs. I mean, just cook at home, butter, oil, you know, make tasty food. The slight exception is there is now this growth of recipes that are like, take a pack of cheesy puffs and pour cheese spread over it and, you know, mix it with crisps. And, you'd have to be cooking with ingredients and not, if you're cooking with a load of ultra-processed stuff, then it's not right.
I think I know what you're going to say to this. Steffi says, what are your thoughts on vegan or vegetarian alternatives like corn?
So this is really tricky, and I kind of deliberately avoided this a bit in the book, but I've put in two new chapters in the paperback, and I do cover a bit of this. What I'd say is, without getting specifically into corn, they have much lower carbon footprints in general, and some of them are pretty unprocessed. So they are just there's things like tofu and you know, lots of East Asian cultures and South Asian cultures have had meat substitutes for a long time, and they're really good. But the new meat substitute burgers are, their purpose is to make you buy more. They're owned by investors, usually in Silicon Valley, And they're extremely delicious. They're very high in salt and fat and often high in sugar. And so they're not really healthy. So if you're being ethical about carbon, definitely switching away from meat to them is probably a good idea. There's a whole load of nuance to that that I don't want to get into. But they're not healthier, really, than eating real vegetables. And their purpose is not health. I'd also say many of them are made by the same companies that also make the meat. So when you go to a fast food chain and you eat the vegan burger or the vegan sausage roll, you're still paying into the same corporation that's flogging loads and loads of meat and fat and ill health. So if you're trying to be ethical, I'm not sure it's really an ethical decision a lot of the time to buy some of these vegan products.
Sarah says, I'm fully behind you, but...
That's nice. But here we go. Everything before the but is rubbish, isn't it?
But this is an interesting point because a few people kind of sent me messages a little bit like this.
Yeah.
What do you say when people say that you're demonising some food?
So that's a very important critique. I think it is nearly impossible. When we talk about harmful food and when we criticise the food, it's hard not to criticise those that eat it. I've tried very, very hard to take the shame that people feel and heap it onto the companies and the policymakers and the people who work
in
the
food industry. I can hear that.
But there will be people who are living on low incomes that this food is marketed to who cannot afford to buy anything else and nothing else is available to them. And it's really hard to talk about this food without them feeling enormous discomfort. And I have tried to populate the book with people with very different backgrounds to me, with very different expertises. So I want the book to reduce shame and stigma. In terms of demonizing food, there is another important thing, which is the anxiety around eating disorders. And so I was very careful, and I've been speaking a lot with the eating disorders faculty at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And they have early data that shows that some eating disorders seem to be very strongly linked to consumption of ultra-processed food. And that maybe shouldn't surprise us that binge eating disorders, for example, the ultra-processed food might be contributing to them because it is food that's been processed in a way that interferes with our ability to control appetite. And so I think it's really important to talk about the harms of the food. You know, this is a significant form of death and suffering. Now, the British Nutrition Foundation have been, and the food industry have been very skillful at sort of going, oh, this is snobbery. And by criticizing the food, you're marginalizing people who depend on it. I would say that the real shame and stigma comes from the fact that people in this country with even medium incomes can't afford to eat real food, and that makes them ill. And that's where the shame comes from. And just being ill is bad for you. And so trying to change the system, I think a critique of me from the industry that's causing the problem, saying that in trying to solve the problem, I'm contributing to it, it's one of the cruelest and most cynical of their ploys. So these are valid critiques. I'm very aware of who I am, and this is why I hope I never say this is what people should eat. I never make that kind of normative statement. And I sincerely don't care what people eat. I want people to have choice. So I want real food to be affordable and available. I want harmful food to have clear warnings. But I'm not even proposing taxing most of it. I think we probably should tax the worst confectionery, the energy drinks. We do need taxes on them. But for the most part, I want to increase choice, not limit choice.
And this really needs support of government to be able to change this system.
So my research, I published a paper last year, not with doctors and nutritional scientists, but with a group of economists. And we asked a simple question. If you go on the website of any big food company, go on Coke or Nestle, and look at the homepage, and you would think these are charities dedicated to reducing carbon, cleaning up plastic, protecting public health, you know, preventing children in the workplace being exploited. You know, so we just said, can we use their own financial data to test these assertions? And it turns out, of course, when these companies make money, what they spend it on is not rewarding women and children, is not reducing carbon emissions and limiting plastic pollution. What they spend it on is doing share buybacks and paying out dividends. You know, they buy back their own shares to drive up the equity value. And when public health proposals are put to the board by some investors, it's the big institutional investors, the pension funds and the hedge funds, that vote those proposals down. So the companies cannot control themselves. They are part of a system that is just the economic system. I'm not trying to criticize that. But the place we know capitalism works brilliantly well is when it's well regulated. The pharmaceutical industry makes enormous profits, very well regulated. The aviation industry, you know, the automotive industry, we're trying to regulate carbon. So saying that government should regulate the food industry should not be controversial. And by the way, behind closed doors, when you go and speak to what we call the C-suite, you know, the chief executive, you know, the board level of the companies, they all are desperate to be regulated. They know they're selling bad food. You speak to supermarkets. I mean, I said to one big supermarket, could you not switch to being a fruit and veg business? And they're like, well, no, people don't overeat pears, you know, apples spoil, lettuce, you know, we don't have any IP. It's all just sold at, it's sold at market prices. We make our money from the chocolate tray bake, which we make from, you know, palm fat and cheap flour.
Historically, and I was thinking this when I was reading the book, was there a point in history in the last 50, 60 years where we kind of reached a nice balance in terms of, because I think back to like my mum's childhood, where everything would have been an ingredient that, yeah, you know, that she, that her family cooked, her mum or who, you know, whoever was cooking. And then obviously through my childhood, when my mum got her microwave, I remember things changing a bit and things started, you know what I mean? Yeah. Things started being brought in that we could put in the microwave and a whole meal could come out. Was there a point in history where our health was at an almost the optimum because we had that balance?
I think it's really hard looking backwards because partly there were so many historical problems. If we go back to the 50s, I mean, there were a lot of bad things about the 50s.
Well, that's what I mean. There was a lot of bad things.
You couldn't buy a mango, you know. Yeah. It was, or bananas were in short supply. So,
and a lot of people who want us to protect the environment more would say we shouldn't be buying mangoes because they don't grow here.
That's very valid. I think for me, it's perfectly possible to look at the current system and go, it could be so much better. We live in a food apartheid, right? People with enough money can eat better than they have at any point in history. We can buy any food we want from anywhere in the world. We can cook the most amazing food. We've got recipes, cookbooks, but that is not the food that's marketed to us, and it isn't the food that most of us eat most of the time. And so I think looking backwards and going, oh, life was wonderful in the 50s, it wasn't. Life was terrible for loads of people, and people living in poverty ate terrible diets then, and they smoked more and they drank more. You know, that doesn't...
But I guess in the 70s, we didn't have the levels of obesity we have now.
Well, that is...
But we smoked more.
That is true. I mean, in 1990, so one of the goals I think we should have, in 1990, 5% of children left primary school living with obesity. Now it is 25%, okay? Gosh. So that is... It's a tragedy, you know.
And by
also,
the way, that's not, as you said before, that's not a statement of kind of what's going on in their homes. It's just that we've allowed that to happen to our food.
It is a failure of government, and it's a failure of successive governments. You know, it's a failure going back to conservatives, then Labour, then back to conservatives. It causes enormous suffering. It has nothing to do with willpower. We know it has nothing to do with inactivity. It is all to do with the food environment, and it's about the failure of government to regulate corporations. But it's also economic stupidity. So I hate the economic arguments because the moral arguments are so much more powerful. You know, this, we just shouldn't have 25% of kids suffering with this because it will cause them physical and mental and social harm. But that you can, if you are a right-wing hawkish economist and you want a strong military, right, and a, you know, a powerful nation, great sports team to make Britain great again, you know,
British, make your kids healthy.
British children at the age of 5 are this much shorter than 9 centimeters, okay, than their counterparts in Eastern Europe or in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia. If you take a class of, you know, I've got a 6-year-old, if you take her class and you move it to Norway and you put them in a football match against a class of Norwegian kids, the Norwegian kids will look like they're 2 years older, okay? If I'm, you know, about 6 foot tall, if I travel to Northern Europe, I'm very average. You know, we see, and this is all because of diet. So it's economically very stupid. And we see there is an anxiety about the companies. We don't want to damage the economy. We don't want to regulate these companies. Companies do fantastically well when you regulate them. We've never seen, you know, the banks loved being regulated because the banks collapse when they're allowed to do what they want because they sort of have to take these risks. So yeah, it's, we cannot afford not to regulate this industry.
Keep doing what you do. Because I think it's so important. And I think, you know, you're obviously very much the David in this Goliath fight. And I hope that there are plenty more who want to join your fight. Because...
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm a very small part of this. And I should say, I'm riding the crest of a wave that other people built. I mean, there have been people saying this since the 1970s. My mum was saying this in the 1970s, all the way through the 80s and the 90s when I was a kid. So I am piggybacking on the shoulders.
Yeah, there's lots of people who totally believe and do what you're saying, but they're fighting against a system, those that can't get that food on their plates. Very quick personal one. One of my really good friends, Claudia, she Instagrammed in when I put the shout out. She said, can you ask Dr. Chris, why am I addicted to Marks & Spencer's Florentine chocolates? Why is she addicted to Marks & Spencer's Florentine chocolates? Is it for all the reasons you've just said?
So
she'll like the personal shout out and the answer.
Claudia, I mean, you are not the only one, okay? We can look at very specific aspects of those chocolates. So they're incredibly soft. They're very, very energy dense. And one of the things we know about almost all addictive substances, whether we look at nicotine or alcohol, is the speed of delivery is very important. So sugar in a bowl on the table, not very addictive. But if we mix the sugar with fat and we put it in a form that gets into your gut very quickly, whether it's a soft drink or a chocolate, we know that can drive this addictive relationship. But the main reason is some very, very smart people in M&S have put that chocolate, they've tested it on hundreds of people. And this is this is just the way food testing works in general. So I don't know about M&S, but this is the way all the other companies do it. They test it on a few hundred people.
How many can you eat in 10 minutes?
How many can you eat in 10 minutes? And if there's one formulation, people eat 9 in 10 minutes, and there's another formulation and people eat 12 in 10 minutes, that's the one that goes on the shelf. So its purpose is to make money for the owners of the supermarket. And that is where your pension is. So the M&S cannot regulate, they can't do anything other than make chocolate in that way. And that is why the government needs to come in and put some big black octagons on that chocolate and take away the advertising from the chocolate.
Might make them a bit less attractive to you, Claude. Thank you so much for coming in. I feel like we need a second go at this at some point.
I would absolutely love it's been
brilliant having you here. And we've only gone through kind of a quarter of the questions, but I think you get the general sense of what people are wanting to hear about.
They're brilliant questions, and I'd love another bite if you're up for it in the next few months. I'd be absolutely delighted.
Brilliant. I'd love that. Thank you. Well, thank you so much to Dr. Chris for coming in and for being so generous with his time and his knowledge. It's a subject you feel that is just going to grow and grow in the interest that we all have in society in terms of what we're putting in our bodies and the effect it's having on us. And if there are other topics you'd like us to cover on the podcast, please do get in touch. You can either leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, message or comment on my Instagram, which is @GabbyLogan, or follow me on Facebook and submit your suggestions there. You might also want to scroll back through our archives for similar expert episodes. We've got Megan Rossi or Gerontology Professor Rose Ann Kenny. Thanks again to Dr. Chris for his time, to Spiritland Creative, and to you for keeping me company. I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.